Take the PATH or NJ Transit to Newark Penn Station. The college is located at 303 University Ave. And one goal in sight. Come together as a people when they shine the light.
All right. The previous program was the Juliana Forlano Show. Coming up at 7 p.m. will be the town hall discussion about Brooklyn for Sale, the price of gentrification, a community town hall starting at 7 p.m. And this will take you all the way until 9 p.m. here on WBAI. Once again, this is WBAI New York, WBAI.org on the web. And once again, at the 7 p.m. hour, Off the Hook, and the 8 p.m. hour, the PC show are preempted for this special town hall broadcast, Brooklyn for Sale, the Price of Gentrification. And that's what's coming up right now. So stay tuned. This is WBAI New York and WBAI.org on the web.
Culture producer for The Takeaway.
And I'm Rafer Guzman, movie critic for Newsday.
And you're watching Brooklyn Public Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Brick Town Hall, Brooklyn for Sale, the Price of Gentrification. We're really happy that you've chosen to join us, and there are several ways that you can do that tonight outside of just watching. We'll get into some of those things a little bit later, but we always like to start off with a sort of statement of intentionality and let you know just why we're here. And while I'm still wrestling with that one myself, I can tell you that this is our second live town hall that we're bringing to you. We've had two others on racing and civil rights, and the lines were very clear there, right? We had people who were literally losing their lives in the street at the hands of others. But tonight, the question is a little bit more skewed. How do you talk about gentrification when you may feel like you're the victim and the perpetrator? We're going to try to get to the root of that and a lot more tonight with some very esteemed guests and a wonderful crowd that's assembled here. So before we do, I'm very proud to introduce you to a man who has done some extensive work on this subject, and you may even say he wrote the reports on affordable housing, New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It is really great to be in the Brick House live to talk about an issue that really matters to New Yorkers, and I just have a couple of minutes, so I want to just put this out there right now. Skylines in the city change. That's what New York is about. But here's what's missing. Skylines are changing without the input from local neighborhoods. And in so many places all over the city, the bottom line is that so many people moved to neighborhoods a generation ago that nobody wanted to live in. There was no developer that wanted to help you come into a community. There were no people setting up businesses or building schools. Community folks did that. People moved to neighborhoods and created all of these incredible communities. And now at a time when land value is going up because of the sweat equity of people who live in our communities, there are people, speculators, who want to evict entire neighborhoods. And we can't let that happen. And I will tell you that the way that we begin a process of fighting back is by organizing at the grassroots level. We need to go back to the feeling of community-based planning. Decisions cannot be made from City Hall and the developers all the way down to the community. And that's why we issue our reports and talk about why we have to begin to create neighborhoods that take into consideration schools, infrastructure, affordability, making sure that small businesses can survive and that generations can live together. Listen, I'm 54 years old. I got a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old. I do not want my kids to have to live in Iowa and Montana because I can't afford New York someday. They got to take care of me the way I'm taking care of them. And that is something that we have to deal with. We cannot lose our communities, and we cannot break up the fabric of our neighborhoods. But the end of the day, and I think this panel is so equipped to talk about it, we have to go back to our community boards, to our community-based organizations. And as we think about building affordable housing, as we think about recreating the neighborhoods of New York, it has to be also about keeping everybody together. Last thought for all of you, and you know this, we speak 170 different languages from 200 countries. We are the envy of the world. But why would we want to separate and gentrify? Why can't we bring people together and build neighborhoods from the bottom up? When I was growing up in Washington Heights in the 1970s, we had redlining, we didn't have banks, we didn't have investment. But we had people in the neighborhood who watched out for the kids. Every day we knew that if we did the right thing, we got to school, we tried to have a life, that we would elevate. Today, the feeling is that people want to separate communities and separate neighborhoods, and that can't happen. So the fact that we have lost 400,000 apartments that rent for less than $1,000 a month over the last 12 years tells all of us that we have a housing crisis that must be dealt with, and it must be dealt with now if we're going to be the great city that we are. Enjoy this forum. Really, I just want to say to Brian, thank you very much. You're a tough interviewer, so watch out for this guy. But let's start organizing and stop agonizing. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jim Carter. Thank God you're in there. So again, thank you, New York City Comptroller Scott Stringer, and thank you all for being here. Allow me to introduce these people right now. This is Jarrell Ben, who is from the Flatbush Tenants Coalition, you can clap for them. They've been doing the work for a long time on the ground, and Jarrell is one of the lead organizers there. Thanks for being here, Jarrell.
Thank you.
Next to Jarrell is Neil DeMaus, who is an author. You've seen his work all around the city in local and national publications, and I'm happy to say he's the author of a forthcoming book that is The War, The Fight for Brooklyn. Brooklyn Wars.
Brooklyn Wars.
Brooklyn Wars. Next to Mr. DeMaus is the New York City Council member from the 36th District, which includes the neighborhoods of Bed-Stuy and North Crown Heights, which don't know anything about gentrification. Robert Cornegy is here. All right, next to Council Member Cornegy is Ron Schiffman. Along with being a Jane Jacobs Medal winner, Mr. Schiffman has been a pioneer in urban planning and is also a professor at Pratt. Thanks for being here, Mr. Schiffman. I appreciate it. And Juan Ramos is here from the Brooklyn Triangle. They are in the fight for sustainable, local, sensible development for one of the best neighborhoods in Brooklyn, in my opinion. And thank you for being here, Juan. We appreciate it. And finally, allow me to introduce you to Sharon Zukin, who is a pioneering professor in a field called urban sociology. And she's the author of several books on the subject and a thought leader in the field. And we welcome you to our panel tonight. So thank you for being here. Just as a housekeeping note, I should let you know we are live on Brooklyn Independent Media. Thank you for tuning in, whether you're online or watching at home or from the stoop or the theater. Thank you for being here in the Brick House. And we're also being broadcast live on WBAI through our broadcast partners there. So wherever you are, you can tune in. And we also want to let you know we're in the Twitterverse and online throughout this evening's discussion. We're going to be running some of your live tweets on the wall behind us. So whether you're sitting here, you're listening online, online or on the radio, feel free to use that hashtag #BeHeard to share your thoughts or concerns or questions. Now, we really wanted to get to the essence of what gentrification is. When we were planning this thing, we had so many back and forth meetings and all out shouting matches in the best friendly at work voices way about what gentrification is and the effects of the thing. So we decided, instead of us giving what we thought, we would go out to Brooklyn with our team, and that's exactly what we did. So allow me to share with you the street eye view of gentrification, as told by Brooklynites.
Gentrification is forced homelessness.
Gentrification to me is having to live in a neighborhood you never would have thought of living in because you can't afford to live in the neighborhoods that you would normally want to live in.
It's a beautiful thing that people who've been here through the hardships for 15, 20 years get to experience it until they get kicked out.
Gentrification means to me change.
Well, I don't know what gentrification means.
Gentrification to me is money, something that's provided for the middle and higher class.
Gentrification means safety.
Mixed community.
Moving out.
Para mí significa nueva comunidad.
So that was just one afternoon toward a definition of gentrification. That was people on the street. So I've got a few people who've been thinking about the idea. So I'm going to start with you, Jarrell. What is your working definition of gentrification?
Wow, you're starting with me, huh?
Starting right with you. You're in the hot seat.
Okay, as an organizer on the ground, I would consider gentrification to be the integration of new peoples. Typically, what I've been seeing is, as the video mentioned, higher income than the people who were living there already, just an integration of new people coming into the community. So that's like a basic definition, just the integration of new people coming into a community.
Professor Zukin, take us to class on gentrification.
It's true that new people come in and they are higher income people, usually more highly educated people. So they have both economic capital and cultural capital. They have a lot of resources and they can command more space in the neighborhood than the people who have been living there for some time. So gentrification starts out as a class issue. Mm-hmm. But it can also become a race issue, and it can become a lever of displacement. It all depends on how far you trust the market to regulate neighborhoods.
Neil?
I think to what was just went on in the video, it's gentrification is not just about change, obviously. There are neighborhoods that change all the time in Brooklyn and in all over the place. In all kinds of directions, and that there isn't that same pushing people out aspect. Money is obviously a huge factor, and I would add power. That gentrification is always a matter of people with power to define what the neighborhood is about coming in and deciding that, and the people who may have been living there for a very long time not having say in that.
All right, Ron. Juan.
I think for me that definition has changed over the years, and every single day I add another element to it. But I would say that it's a process by which people who have lived in a community for a long time have now, and cultivated that community, are now forced with moving out based on the social conditions that are coming about. So it is about that economic class. It is about that being forced out because of the rents. But it's also, I have to say, bad policy. Bad policy by the city. Bad policy by the city and how they do rezonings.
Okay, it's nothing personal that I'm going to the council member after a note about bad policy, but Council Member Cornyn, your definition.
So, Brian, do you want my council member political definition, or do you want my person who lives in one of the most gentrified areas?
Give us your kitchen table version.
My kitchen table. Well, that starts with an anecdote. My wife and I were in a debate over gentrification, very heated debate. And the people at the debate turned to us and said, we're talking about you. Because my wife and I had gone away to college, right, come back with graduate degrees, and found ourselves being considered gentrifiers, even though my dad was a pastor in that area and my wife's father was an entrepreneur for the entire their entirety in the community. So it's a very touchy subject, as you can imagine.
Professor Schiffman.
Well, I don't really like to talk about gentrification. I like to talk about the problem that comes from bad public policy, and that's the displacement of people. And I remember when I first started working in Brooklyn, I'm sort of the old man on the panel, the old person on the panel. I started working in Bed-Stuy in 1964, and the issue that we were addressing then with the Central Brooklyn Coordinating Council and other community-based groups was how do we stem the outflow of people, the displacement of people. And what we saw in Brooklyn at that period of time was disinvestment, and the victims of that disinvestment were poor people. What we're seeing now is a lot of reinvestment and accelerated investment, and the victims of that are poor people. So it gets back to the first panel you had a couple of weeks ago. The issue of race, the issue of class, the issue of discrimination is intimately woven into the issues that we're discussing here today. Mm-hmm. How do we come up with public policies that benefit people who are of low income in such a way that they're not driven out of the neighborhoods that they strove and worked hard to build? And if you look at Bed-Stuy, you look at Crown Heights, you look at Fort Greene, those communities survived because people came together and kept those communities alive. And it's their success that is now facing them right in the face with the problem of being pushed out, because now those areas are very desirable.
So speaking of that desirability, I know that you were there for the beginning of the Bed-Stuy Restoration Corporation. You were one of the people who sort of pioneered this effort to bring that center and that energy to Bed-Stuy. What is it going to take now to keep the people who have been there for the duration in the community to enjoy those benefits?
Well, you know, I have to be honest. I don't think there's anything that's on the horizon by the city, state, or federal government that's going to be able to do that, because you can't turn crap into gold through some sort of alchemy. We need to generate the resources by which to reinvest in our neighborhoods to produce low-cost housing that's affordable to low-income people. And it's really critically important that we begin to fight for those resources. The mayor's program, for instance, of 2080 housing, this inclusionary zoning, it's a very good program to bring about integration. It's not a good program to meet the needs of low-income people and to stabilize the loss of low-cost housing that's occurring in our cities. We need new laws to protect tenants. We need new laws to make sure that we stem the speculation that's taking place in our areas. We need to be aggressive around what are the ways we find new monies to invest in our communities so that they benefit all the people that live there.
So, Jarrell, you are an organizer and you're out there. Is there a way to buy our way out of this problem? If we backed up a Brinks truck into your office, would you guys just shut down and walk away? Money is here, problem solved?
I think money is, just to answer your question, no. I think money is a huge part of the problem, because that gives the landlords incentives, the owners, to harass and push out the tenants. Their goal is to deregulate the apartments and, in a sense, get more money and a higher turnover rate for those apartments.
Right.
So while money is the basis and the ground of what's causing the problem, I don't think money is going to solve it. I think that people need to be aware and take a collective stand, and the rent laws that protect the tenants, that are weakened and are not really doing their job of protecting the tenants, those laws need to be strengthened. So money plays a part in that as well, because I don't know if I should say this, but I know that, you know, people who are making those laws are, yeah, are affected by money as well. But I think that in a sense that money is not how we are going to combat it. I think demanding stronger rent laws, being more aware and more active in the fight for stronger rent laws is really what's going to make more of a difference than any amount of money can. Money will help us to organize. Money will pay for more organizers, more facilities, more, you know, copies of flyers or whatever, but it won't be an end all to the problem.
So if we were sitting here and this wasn't a town hall, it was Gentrification the Musical, who would the bad guy be? We, you know, we're very good at drawing these lines and we're going to rally against them. We're going to the steps of City Hall to say this is the bad guy. But what face is going to be on the poster? Surprise. I hear some suggestions from the audience. Let's hear some from the
surprise
panel.
Twist is that we all did it. Yeah. I mean, but no, you know, there's a lot of different forces at work, right? You've got the fact that there is this tremendous pressure. I mean, the city and this nation has changed tremendously in the last 30, 40 years. You have a lot more inequality. You have a lot more people with the money to come in and buy people, you know, spend people into the ground. Mm-hmm. At the same time, city policy has changed tremendously. And, you know, city policy is, whether you want to be giving it the benefit of the doubt or not, either still fighting the wars of, you know, 40 years ago when the goal was how do we get people to want to live here, or is, you know, just helping to, you know, exacerbate the trend that we're already talking about here in terms of the money and, you know, helping the money get done what it wants to do. And, it's incredible. I mean, you know, the more I research it, I feel like the more complicated it gets. Yeah. But you have to understand sort of the interaction, right, of those two forces if you're going to in any way try and stop it.
Councilmember Cornegy, you sit on the Housing and Buildings Committee. You are intimately involved in exactly these sorts of things. Is there a way to legislate, or even as the mayor might be leading us to believe, build our way out of this problem?
No, the first thing we have to do is protect the affordable units that are on the market. That's number one. Because you can't build your way out of this. In a district like mine where there's no more land left,
right,
you know, that's very difficult to do.
Just as a given, and I'm sorry to jump on that, but you have to legislate your way out of it and make sure that we preserve the affordable housing.
Right, I said you cannot legislate your way out of it. You have to protect the affordable housing units that are here first and foremost. And that's one of the most robust things that we're attempting to do, which is, you know, incentivizing landlords who keep their units affordable. Those units that are in the 15-year program, when they're about to come out, you know, go back to those landlords and re-incentivize them to stay in the program, right? So most of these programs have a shelf life, mm-hmm, right? And being proactive as a council in seeking out those individuals who've participated in programs are now, you know, are sunsetting,
right,
making sure, find out what their interests are and trying to meet that interest.
Made easier or harder by a person who's an assembly speaker who allegedly is getting money from the interests working against exactly?
Well, I wondered how long it would take before Shelley Silver came up in this conversation. So listen, what we've seen even on a city level in elections has been, you know, influx and infusions of capital in an attempt to influence even who the council members are, right?
From the
Real Estate Board of New York was one of the biggest contributors to campaigns in the city, right? I was almost a victim to that, where there were hundreds of thousands of dollars spent against me in a campaign to have another candidate there. So, you know, there are all kinds of things that we have to look at, not just the affordable unit. We have to look at who are the major players in this process of redeveloping and reshaping the complexion, and not literal complexion, but the complexion of how the city goes forward. And some of us are willing to do that. You know, I didn't get on the Housing and Buildings Committee by accident. That was intentional for me in an effort to be front and center as to what the city is doing as it relates to affordable housing units. So the first thing we have to do is protect the affordable units.
Well, Comptroller Stringer, in his report, they detail that some 200,000 units have become deregulated over the past three decades. Professor Schiffman, is there an instance of someone who's doing it right? can we look to a city, a municipality, a town, anywhere in the United States even, to be a model?
I don't think we can. I think we really have to do what we used to do in New York City, and that's set the new direction and the new policies that do that. You know, we did that right after World War II when we had a housing crisis. We instituted rent control. We need a new form of rent protection to protect the tenure of people who live in those buildings. We need to go back to the banks. You know, in the 60s and 70s, actually, communities across the country organized to make sure that the banks first forced banks to disclose where they were giving mortgages because of redlining, the discriminatory pattern by which banks lend. Today, I think what we need to do is revisit the Community Reinvestment Act and look at the banks that are now lending to property owners that are displacing people. Because the benefit of CRA is to benefit low-income people and low-income neighborhoods. And if we're going into those neighborhoods, buying those buildings, displacing the tenants who live there that were low-income, then it's no longer meeting that low-income requirement. So we should get the regulators to start looking at the banks that are feeding speculation in many of our neighborhoods. We really need to start looking at how we institute new tax laws to take back for the public coffers to subsidize residents that live there, monies that could be that come from overheated speculation that's taking place. You look at some of the industrial areas now, land prices have gone up threefold since the mayor has announced his rezoning proposals. Why not tax back that benefit so we can use that to provide low-cost housing in the city of New York? We've got to start thinking a little bit more creatively and a little bit more dramatically, because the issue that faces us is not going to go away, and it's not going to be addressed by just minor measures.
So Juan, I think you know a little something about those industrial areas that have tripled in value.
Well, I think Ron is absolutely correct. I think one of the things we also need to do is also get some of these developers that benefit from a lot of these rezonings to do something about it themselves and give back to the community in the same way that they receive from the community. Mm-hmm. But that also starts at Borough Hall, it starts at City Hall, and it starts with all the elected officials that we elect to represent us, but always end up in rooms, back rooms, dealing these things on their own. I think it needs to be a little bit more transparent in order for the community to be part of the process, because bad rezonings lead to, you know, people being pushed out. And if, for example, you look at the Broadway Triangle, which I chair, the coalition, we were a victim of that, where bad rezoning led to developers now building basically a segregated neighborhood, a neighborhood that is segregated not because these developers don't have the right to build as of right because it's their property, but the bad policies in place allow them to do that. That's the problem.
Yeah.
And that's the problem we need to fix. Part of that also is that we need to be vigilant of some of our city agencies. HPD, for example, is charged with following the Federal Fair Housing Act, which in our case, they admitted on the stand in the court that they didn't follow. And they were supposed to see if that had a desperate impact on the community that it was being developed on.
Okay.
And they admitted not to doing that. So why are we still in a fight over the Broadway Triangle? Why are we not making changes and changing the policies that led to that? Why are we still in these conversations is the question.
Sharon, knowing that there is a fight over the Broadway Triangle and all of those points that he just introduced, I'm going to ask you to put bifocals on your brain for a minute and take a 40,000 square foot view from above and a street level view to see. We're walking in these neighborhoods, we're bumping up against people who we might not recognize from the neighborhood previously, and we may be looking at each other like the enemy, but it's clear that there are some systems in place. And as that young man said, it got a few laughs and some head scratches, but gentrification means I have to live in a neighborhood that I never heard of or maybe even wanted to, because I can't afford to live where I think I should live. From a sociological standpoint, that's kind of schizophrenic.
Oh, it's schizophrenic, but a lot of cultural work is done to prepare people to think of dystopic neighborhoods as utopias. In other words, some years ago, the idea of living in the suburbs represented the good life.
You made it.
But yeah, but now living in Fort Greene might be, or Bed-Stuy might be the good life. Mm-hmm. And you look at the movies, you look at the media, you look at the restaurants, you look at the restaurant reviews, and people are reconstructing the reputations mm-hmm. of neighborhoods around cultural goods in a way that the longtime residents can't really share, or they could share to some degree. Everybody likes an orderly neighborhood, clean streets, but not everybody can plunk down $50 for a dinner. Mm-hmm. So I think that the enemy is us in many ways, even though us may be five college students rooming together, but paying together a higher rent than a working class family can pay. Now, I really appreciate the creative thinking that the other panelists have just shown. It's, you know, it's tremendous. But who among us is really going to be vigilant? Who has the time and the energy, the commitment mm-hmm. to be so vigilant and to hold elected officials' feet to the fire? Our community boards are just not structured for that. And city governments don't have the resources to build. The federal government is not helping city governments to build public housing anymore. We don't have home rule, so the rent control and rent stabilization laws that are on the books are not really up to us. So there's a lot to target for us.
There's a lot of kicking the can down the road. But what I wanted to say in response was that for some of us, living in Bedford-Stuyvesant and Northern Crown Heights has always been the good life. I just want to clarify that. Yes. I mean, if you look at the architecture, which is the same now as it was in 1960, some of us who are long-term residents have a distaste for gentrification based on some of the new comments that we're hearing, just from an anecdotal standpoint. I just wanted to point that out.
Thank you for that point. So how do you know that your neighborhood's being gentrified?
I'll tell you what some of my students at Brooklyn College say. When I walk out on the street and I see a white man jogging, right? That was one thing that a student said. And it might not be fair or typical, but that's one way. Or for example, and this I heard from a student who lives in Bed-Stuy, I walked out the door and I heard people speaking French, and they weren't Haitians. So,
and for some of us long-term residents, when we see white people with a baby in a stroller.
I think
a big result of gentrification that's not being spoken about is the businesses too. I realized how rapidly and how immensely downtown this area was gentrifying when every single mom and pop local business, IHOP, beauty supply store that was there for all my life, just all got shut down within a span of like months. They were all gone. And I think that that's a clear indication when local businesses that have been there for years in the community start to all of a sudden shut down mm-hmm. one after one after one. Mm-hmm. Yep, gentrification.
So on that point, as the chair of small business, I do have to say that there's a uniqueness in Bed-Stuy and Northern Crown Heights in the fact that we're still 69% minority owned in terms of our businesses. And one of the things my office has concentrated on, two of the things we've concentrated on through this gentrification is to protect our cultural institutions, which we have a few of, which are great, and they provide programming in and around an African-American culture. And also, we build capacity within our small businesses through access to capital and access to technical assistance. Because if you ask any small business what they'd like more of, it's customers. And through gentrification, there are more customers. How do you get them in your doors, conversations that we have? How do you make your stores attractive to a new market is what we have. So there are some people who are seeking after long-term doing business, seeking ways to capitalize on a new market. That's capitalism 101, is to capitalize on a new and emerging market. So, I got to point out that there are some entities that are looking to benefit from a changing demographic.
Those businesses are very fortunate to have that option, but a lot do not. A lot get bought out and don't even have the option or the choice. And that's, you know, that's the reality of what gentrification is. If you can stay, you that's good. But a lot of people are not given that option. Businesses and people and tenants, they're not given the choice or the matter to stay. They're being bought out and forced out. And I think that's the main problem here.
One of the pieces of legislation that I've just authored is a piece of legislation which calls on business owners to be subsidized. Just the same way we do the rent subsidies for seniors and for disabled, we have a piece of legislation in now that would incentivize building owners to keep affordable rents for small businesses that have proven themselves within the district. And we wrote a resolution and actually helped author the state legislation that the resolution supports. So we're hoping in this session that's something that will get some attention and be able to provide for those businesses who are not able to provide for themselves or don't have a bid or don't have a merchants association and are able to do that. So
Neil, as we talk about these ripple effects of this thing that we're sort of naming now, you've been out on the streets collecting these stories. The book is coming. It's been 10 years worth of work. What are the stories that you're hearing?
I mean, everything that people are talking about here, really. You know, I was just last week talking to someone in Bushwick who's been there, I think, 15, 20 years, you know, longtime residents, and she said she can't find anyone to rent to her because she has kids, you know? And this is something that, you know, hadn't occurred to me as someone who's not going through that, but, you know, just the fact that you've got these massive numbers of young people who are willing to live to an apartment, right? And landlords can say, hey, you know, we just don't want to deal with kids. You know, we'd rather have four wage earners coming in there. And, you know, they are definitely going to be able to pay $3,000 a month rent. And it's a huge crisis. You know, the number of you know, different iterations of this are tremendous.
Is that Bushwick, yeah. Bushwick or Northern
this
Williamsburg?
Bushwick. Not the industrial park. This is Bushwick.
So if we're talking about this, this gets to the heart of one of the most important questions that we don't often get a chance to hear voiced. Is number one the feminization of poverty, with a woman with children not being able to find an affordable, viable apartment for her family.
It's a couple, by the way, and they're working, so it's not even that they don't have money.
Okay, yeah. And to further expand then, is gentrification now a civil rights issue?
Absolutely.
Totally. Yes.
For our people who are listening on radio, they nodded their heads, yes.
No, I said absolutely.
Absolutely. So unpack that for us. Is gentrification, we've been deeply involved in civil rights. We've had two town halls here, but it doesn't immediately come to mind for lots of people that the very act of gentrification or being in a place could be a civil rights issue.
Well, I like what Mr. Schiffman said earlier, which is that it's the way that gentrification acts in communities like ours, that's the problem. And it's what comes along with gentrification and all of those displacement and those kinds of things, you know, are really, really a problem. And if you look at it closely, and some of the greatest minds are now looking at it saying it absolutely is or can be denoted as a civil rights issue. Mm-hmm. So I would have to agree there with that.
Yeah, I would like to second that as well. Being an organizer on the ground and really experiencing right along with my tenant leaders, which are the members of the Flatbush Tenant Coalition, we call them leaders, and just seeing the conditions that they have to live in and the harassment that they're subjected to, everything that the landlords and their owners of the buildings do to get them out of these apartments, it definitely hands down becomes a civil rights issue because their rights as human beings are being infringed upon. Their children are being affected. You know, just a little story about one of our buildings on Newkirk Avenue. They want to take criminal charges up against their landlord because their children were rushed to the hospital because for the umpteenth time, the ceiling had collapsed on top of them. Mm. And this is something that happens. It's a normal thing, unfortunately. And because these landlords have so much incentive to deregulate the apartments that they're just doing whatever it takes to get these people out. And these are their homes that they've lived in for years, for decades, for centuries. And they're just being forced out just so that they can deregulate the apartments and new people can come in and be overcharged. So it definitely becomes a civil rights issue, the impacts, the effect that gentrification has on these neighborhoods.
So where's the enforcement? There was an interesting article in the New York Times the other day about housing court in Brooklyn mm-hmm. and how dysfunctional that court is. Where's the enforcement? Where is the will? Where's the political will to enforce even the laws that are on the books?
Yeah.
Well, as long as the laws are on the books, we know that we're 5 minutes away from June 15th when the current mm-hmm. rent rules are set to expire. Where is the heat now to get those things strengthened or even at the very least preserved? Well, you've got the heat, I imagine.
Yeah, it's right here, right in Flatbush and in Crown Heights, and where the organizing groups around the city are definitely coming together. And we had a housing justice march. There were some marches in the Bronx. Like, people are trying to get the word out, but I think that the only way that it can be more of a mass collective effort is if everyone joins in. Like, if everyone in this room were like, we're going to go march in the streets or yeah. Maybe on the sidewalk or however you want to do it so we don't get arrested. I think that's what needs to happen. People need to take action and come together. It's not just me as an organizer. Like, even when my job as an organizer is finished, I'm still a Brooklyn tenant. I still come home and live in Brooklyn, so it's never over. And just a point that was made that I disagree with, that like it got kind of like yeah. it left that point, was saying like who would be the enemy in the musical. I think it would be the system that allows for this to happen, because the people, I would never say that I'm the enemy or I'm the villain, because I'm the victim, you know, as an organizer and someone living in, who've lived in Brooklyn all my life. Like, I didn't ask for this to happen. I didn't ask for the neighborhood to gentrify. So I feel it's a little unfair to blame the people and say it's us, because we didn't allow the systems to be like this. We didn't allow the laws to be weakened. We could have probably took a more a stance against it, but I would definitely disagree and say the system as a larger entity would be the enemy, would be the villain that we're up against, because it's what we're fighting and it's what's causing this to happen and what's allowing this to happen.
Okay.
If the rent laws were stronger, then this wouldn't be an issue.
And I just want to add to that I think we also need to begin the process by which people elect the people that that sit on these boards that are responsible for, you know, pushing these things on us, instead of being appointed by some elected officials who have obviously their own purpose for putting such people on those boards. Because that's one of the problems too. People can show up all they want. We've rallied and rallied all we've wanted. But at the end of the day, it's those elected officials and those people with the interests that sit in those rooms making those decisions, you know, that they come back and smile at us and say, we tried our best for you.
What's the roadmap for that, Professor?
Yeah, I do think, you know, we're at a moment in time because of the silver scandal mm-hmm. where we really need to talk about the way the state operates vis-a-vis the city. Mm-hmm. And to have the state making decisions over a local issue like rent and community is just an outrage. We should be able to point to our council members and say, you're responsible, but they're not. They can't do that. I think we need to use this opportunity to demand from the Democratic Party and the Republican Party statewide that we finally get a state legislature that's accountable to its people in the various different communities, and that the city of New York begin to exercise some of its own local powers over local issues. And I think it's critically important that we begin to open up that debate, because if we don't, we're going to constantly be under the thumb of the state that will be more beholden to real estate industry than it will be to the people in the city of New York. It really is important that we begin to figure out ways of breaking down both the state and the federal government to join the city in addressing these issues. But the city can't just absolve itself of responsibility. We need to do things. The council members' initiative around small business is really important. Mm-hmm. We need to force businesses, primarily property owners, to not allow for rapid increases in rents, seeing rents on commercial strips going up 2 to 3 times when it comes up for renewal. Why not force them into arbitration or something of that nature? Let's begin to look at what tools we have locally, what tools we need to get from the state, and really begin to develop both a coalition that brings together all of the parties in the city of New York to begin to demand those changes. Because otherwise, we're just talking. We really need to begin to do something that leads to action.
Councilmember?
I think I would be remiss if I didn't mention that, you know, in my district is Community Board 3. And if anybody here has been to Community Board 3 meetings, there are 200-300 people at every meeting. And they have a rather robust committee assignments. You asked earlier, what does gentrification look like? So in Bedford-Stuyvesant, it looks like a slew of bar openings on every block and every corner. Well, let me just tell you something. Community Board 3 is on top of that. Yeah. And has decided that they won't allow, within reason, for the complexion of the community and the nightlife to be changed in such a way that it benefits a new demographic and doesn't benefit the existing demographic. So there are mechanisms in place that you can have a say-so in what happens, right? And I'm not pushing this off. I was a community board member and co-chaired Health and Human Services before I ever became a council member, because I wanted to get involved at whatever level I could get involved before government. So there are many people who've chosen to do that in their communities of choosing. I gotta suggest that you go back to those entities and those structures that are set up to help you deal with some of the things, right? Yeah. So we know that this elephant in the room, which is housing, is a huge elephant, right? And, you know, they tell me, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time, right? Yeah. Not that I advocate for the eating of any animals. let's be clear, especially elephants or horses. For that matter, but there are some systems that are in place that seem to be able to give the residents of their respective communities a voice. And I just wanted to say that community boards, when organized correctly and with the correct leadership, provide that.
I feel like it's a huge issue because, like, you know, lots of people here are doing fantastic work. Community boards are doing good work. You know, this has been going on for as long as I've been alive in New York City. And at the same time, you know, our voices are not necessarily the ones that are getting heard the most, right? You know, I mean, the Real Estate Board of New York is always going to get heard more than anyone sitting here in this panel. You know, the New York Times, as much as it does great work covering issues of poverty and housing and all this other stuff, the voices of the gentrifiers, you know, the issues of the gentrifiers are always going to be heard more in the New York Times than, you know, the issues of the gentrified. And I guess my question for the panel is, what is it going to take to get, you know, these voices heard and these concerns heard? What is necessary for the system, right, that is not set up to do this, to actually be forced to or to care to, you know, hear this and say this is something that we have to act on because, you know, it's a crisis. It's not just business as usual.
I want to follow up on what Neil just said. It's crucial for community voices to be heard, but it's also crucial for more powerful voices to ally themselves with the communities. And the New York Times was at the top of my mental list. It's really difficult, I'd say it's impossible, to get any view published in the Times as an op-ed piece, for example, that argues in favor of rent control. I remember a number of years ago, I submitted an op-ed piece to municipalize Con Ed or something like that. Yeah, that went over like a lead balloon. But the Times does have a very influential voice. Maybe there's some way for the public architecture critic, Michael Kimmelman, or somebody to say more about what's happening in communities in terms of conversions of property. Maybe it's time for the Municipal Arts Society, which has had a very active community supporting.
Had,
okay. Even in Flatbush, they had something, right? You know, some kind of program. They've done great things. They've had quite a lot of influence on certain kinds of development in New York City. Why don't they lend their voice to community voices? So, you know, maybe we have to find some cracks in the power structure.
I think the New City Club, which came out of the fact that MAS moved away from being engaged and it reinvigorated the City Club might be the kind of ally that will do that. And I think, at least talking to some of them, they're taking on the issue. So I think you're on the right track. I think we really need to build those alliances.
Have we agreed, though, that some of this is driven by... So I know as a city government, we're responsible for being a stopgate for some of the overdevelopment and the... But there are real estate speculators who have inflated home prices, who have done things in the short term to make a lot of money.
Many of whom don't even live in this country.
Absolutely. So, I mean... You know, if anybody was on trial here, it would be the whole capitalist system that really, you know. And again, I really want to sit intently and get an idea on what I can do to be a better councilperson in all of this. So I don't want to get into vilifying people, but I'm kind of clear, you know, where some of this originated from. Because when I look at speculators, speculators have already, to some degree, left Bedford-Stuyvesant, because when a brownstone's worth 1.8, they can't be there anymore. So they're already in East New York and Brownsville. So we know where they're going, almost like we can kind of chart their territory and try to cut off what we've seen happen in Fort Greene, Clinton Hills, Bed-Stuy. Like it's this clear path, that swath that's been cut out of central Brooklyn. So you know, we really have to look at where this is driven and how much money is actually made in this. So we're unfortunately in this reactionary position,
right,
which really doesn't serve the city and my constituency or the constituency of the city very well.
Well, let's talk about that acceleration. Professor Zukin, as an urban sociologist, I read something that you wrote about the fact that this seems like a process on steroids, where in planning for this, we thought, oh, gentrification as a natural process. Maybe an immigrant family who lived on the Lower East Side really pulled themselves up by their bootstraps and made it to the suburbs. So they left all these spaces that became occupied by other people trying to climb their way up the ladder. But now that was gentrification, and now we see it as...
No, that's not gentrification. That's upward social mobility.
Upward social mobility is different than gentrification.
It's different. Those of us with longer histories and longer memories remember the earlier periods of disinvestment. And, in a way, we really are tied to the ebb and flow of capital. Right? I mean, we're all living in the same system. So the disinvested areas of some years ago become attractive once again when investors, capitalists, developers, speculators, foreign investors in real estate trusts, when they're looking to park their money somewhere. They say, oh, it's not so expensive to invest over there. Okay. So, you know, I'm not trying to be a fatalist about this at all, but I am trying to say that there's an individual view and even a group view. Sometimes groups experience upward social mobility together.
Right.
But we also are contending with these movements of big amounts of capital investment. And even medium amounts of capital investment that find the soft spots in the property system, and somehow we have to be in control, or try to be in control of all of these processes. But, you know, people do talk about ethnic succession, for example.
Yeah.
Oh, one ethnic group moves in. And then a lot of their members do well, they move out.
Right.
And then the next ethnic group comes in, so on and so forth. But now we're in such a tight competition for space that there's no smooth passage out of our city. So it's we're really fighting over what's here.
Well, speaking of that fight, earlier we all alluded to the fact that in one instance you might be the gentrifier one day, and 6 months later when lease renewal time comes, you might be the gentrified. So in asking what can we do as neighbors to humanize this issue and not look at the person who moved in as the enemy. If we're going to dismantle a system and these mechanisms, how can we begin to build coalitions? But as you guys think about your succinct answers to that question, I'm going to let you know that in about 10 minutes, we're going to open up to questions so we can put the town in the town hall. So for the next hour, we'll have an exchange between these smart people and you smart people. So if you do have a question, please make your way to the sides, to the microphones, and then we're going to get into those questions. So how do we start to see friends and neighbors as friends and neighbors, even if we're just meeting them?
Well, I think that directly relates to the work that I do. I'll go inside a building in our catchment area, Flatbush area, and I'll just talk to people, and you'll realize that the problems that the older Caribbean or minority tenants are experiencing are the same problems that the newer, you know, white tenants are experiencing, or the newer other ethnicities are experiencing. And once we found that common ground, there was less of a looking at each other as enemies. They realize you're all tenants in the same building and all neighbors. So once you take a collective stand, it's way easier for us to put pressure on their owner that they both share. They both have the same landlord, to put pressure to do the repairs, to stop the harassment. You know, we get more information about the building to find out if they're slowly, illegally deregulating the apartments within the building. So I think the first step for just everyday people on the ground is to just don't look at, you know, the new people coming in as your enemy, because they're going to be subject to the same problems you are. They're most likely being overcharged. Whatever repair issues you're having in the building and whatever harassment you're having, they most likely will have that same problem, because the landlord, the people, the developers, they're not looking at it like we want white people in the neighborhood. They're looking at it like we want money, and we want to exploit everyone we can to get more money. So, you know, it's like you just come together, make a collective stand against the problem, and that's where you can start.
I see you, Neil.
I agree with you, and I don't agree with you. I think you're right that they want money, and that's the bottom line. I think, you know, one of the things we're dancing around here is the issue of race, and I think wanting white people is all about wanting money, you know? I mean, you see it in neighborhood after neighborhood, right? There's like this succession pattern of waves of people. First, you have the folks who move there when nobody else wanted to live there, right? Which is mostly usually people of color and immigrants.
Yeah.
Then you have the artists, right? The folks who will live anywhere as long as it's cheap, and they're perfectly fine living with people who, you know, in a neighborhood with people who may not look like them. And then you have the people who say, hey, wow, that neighborhood's really cool. There's a bunch of white artists there. I feel comfortable there, you know, the sort of. And then come the people who say, oh, wow, look, you know, I feel totally fine. You know, that's not a, you know, neighborhood of color or dangerous or something like that. That's someplace where I'm going to see a lot of people who look like me. And each stage, right? So I feel like the first step is for potential gentrifiers, which is all of those people except for the first one, is to be aware of where you are in the process, right? And to say, okay, you know, it's something I face, right? You know, I'm sort of a middle-class white person living in Brooklyn. I have been pushed out of neighborhoods, and I have gone into other neighborhoods and probably rented apartments that other people then couldn't afford because I was paying more.
Right.
And you have to be aware of it, and you have to be willing to say, okay, what can, you know, how can we sort of all work together on this? But it's hard, you know?
Yeah, I would agree to disagree, because I think that that may be how it originally appeared, like, and that may be how it was at one point in time, but the lines are getting skewed. Like, as the councilman said, he's, you know, a black man who became successful, came back into his neighborhood, and now he's the gentrifier. So I think that the lines are getting skewed, because number one, it's happening so rapidly, gentrification, and you don't know who's walking around anymore. You can't look at a neighborhood and say that's a typically black neighborhood anymore. You just can't do that, because the lines are becoming so skewed, and it's becoming so gentrified so rapidly that neighborhoods that were predominantly white and black is like, it's just like a melting pot of mix now. It just doesn't look the same anymore.
But what I would argue is that if he grew up in that neighborhood and now he comes back and stays, he's not a gentrifier. He's a product of a policy that we should be pursuing. And I think that one of the big antidotes to gentrification is if we really invest in our communities so that they grow socially and economically and politically and powerfully. Yeah. We really have to begin to do that rather than have a strategy that says the city renews itself by replacing the people who are there. How do we develop the programs? I'm not arguing with you. I'm just building on what you're saying. How do we build the programs that allow them to develop to the point where they are the next middle-income population, so that people aren't trapped in poverty, but you can actually grow a community so that it can grow economically and politically?
I think in order to build coalitions that may work in that way, you also need those that are considered gentrifiers coming in to really study the neighborhood, mm-hmm. understand where they're moving into, because sometimes what happens is that the culture there suffers, right? And I will give you an example, Graham Avenue in Williamsburg, where many of the businesses Latino owned. Yeah. Over the summer, we had a whole big movement trying to preserve these two record shops who made their business by, you know, having their music playing from their storefront. All of a sudden, gentrifiers are moving in, and they're
311,
and now all of a sudden they can't play their music, which has led to some of them closing. Yeah. So we have, you know, and to his credit, you know, I want to give the council member credit for building those type of things to really look at protecting businesses that are there and have been there. Because some of these businesses, for example, one that I work with over the summer, been there 40-something years.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden he's looking at the possibility of having to close down. That is not right. And it's not right because the person across the street who's calling 301 100 times a day is there because she's, you know, painting her collage or whatever she's doing, and it's bothering her, and you know, now this man has to suffer. So I think in order to build those coalition, mm-hmm. there needs to be a level of respect for the community you're moving into, and understanding that there's culture there.
So, confessions of a black gentrifier.
No.
I happen to be a person who grew up in Chicago. I'm one of your constituents now, of course. I'm in Bed-Stuy. And, you know, I don't consider myself a gentrifier because I grew up in a neighborhood that's like Bed-Stuy. So where do you come in on that scale then? You're the favorite son who came back, but you're still the gentrifier. Give us your capsule.
Well, so speaking of favorite sons that come back, I'm in a district where my children won't be able to come back. Once they graduate.
Depend on you too?
No, I'm saying if things continue the way they are,
right?
It won't be. So I'm very concerned about that. But and just to your point, we have people calling the office saying that the mosque is too loud. Mm-hmm. Can you make them stop praying on Friday? and the church bells on Sunday. I live in the borough of churches. And if Brooklyn is the borough of churches, then Bed-Stuy certainly is the epicenter of churches. So there is no shortage of bell ringing and prayer, which has been an integral part of the survival of that community. And we get a consistent barrage of calls asking to make that stop.
No.
Now, what I understand is this is secular.
Yeah.
And some of this would have happened anyway, except it's exacerbated by the tragedy in Lower Manhattan and the towers falling. Right? So we had a flood of people come into the borough, and everything shifted quicker than it normally would have. So it really turned the entire Brooklyn on its axis.
Right?
So we understand that. Now, how we right that ship is something that, as first and foremost, as a citizen, I'm trying to do. But now with legislative and policy powers, and with collaboration with my state and federal government, we're trying to make sure that we can slow some of it down. But you should know that there are people that are invested in making sure that the sanctity of our communities, which are the life's bread of New York City, remain the same.
So we're going to go to our questions in just a moment, so please get that question ready and tight. But I'm going to do the most unfair thing of the night and ask you to give us your 40-second overview of ethical gentrification.
Of what?
Ethical gentrification. How do you do it ethically? How can this process
happen? There ain't no such thing.
All right, I'm going to cede those 45 seconds to you, ma'am. If you would share your name and neighborhood and really keep it tight so we can get moving.
My name is Alicia Boyd, and I represent Flatbush, Crown Heights, Prospect, Lefferts Gardens. I'm the black side of the park.
Okay, the black
we
side of the
park.
We
all know that side, don't we?
We see where this is going. Get to your question.
Yeah, and I represent a grassroots movement called MTOP, the movement to protect the people. And we have been in a serious rezoning fight with city planning. And the whole idea is to rezone our community to allow luxury developments underneath the so-called provide affordable housing.
So what's the question?
So the question is how does a community supposed to, from the ground up,
right,
control what happens to them and their direction if the policies that mm-hmm. are in place by the mayor's office and city planning tells a community if you do not upzone mm-hmm. a particular boulevard, in this case Empire Boulevard, we will not rezone you.
Okay, Juan, this is happening with you on Broadway right now.
Yeah, I would say that one of the things that we found out during the litigation was the fact that HPD, who was charged with, you know, having to see what kind of an impact racially this would have in the community, that they totally dismissed the Federal Fair Housing Act, which was one of the things that led to the judge giving a favorable outcome for us in the litigation. Now, I would say be vigilant of that, but also that we need to continue to organize, because if we just wait on our electeds, it's not going to, I mean, in our situation, you know, Bed-Stuy and Williamsburg together, over 40 organizations came together and formed this coalition, which I chair, and we were failed at every single step of the way. We were failed at the community board. We were failed when we went to borough hall. We were failed in the city council, and ultimately the mayor's office allowed it to happen. And I think that people have to continue to fight in order to show that we're not going to take it anymore, but also allying ourselves with those electeds who would stand up with us and say no more. Because while we were at city council asking them to favorably vote on our behalf, you know, we were told that council members usually vote with the council member from that district even if they don't like the plan. So that's a problem. But we had 10, for the first time we heard in history, for the first time 10 council members stood up against the council member from the district and said, no, there's something wrong with this project and we don't like it. And we need more elected officials to stand up and say they're not going to tolerate it anymore, that politics as usual, business as usual is hurting people, and that we're going to stop that. So I think part of that has to be a constant. And again, someone recently told me that morality doesn't fit in business. But if we lose, you know, our direction in that moral compass, then we give up everything. So we're the ones that got to keep up the fight, because for us it is a matter of survival in our communities that some people never wanted to live in, and now all of a sudden they find, you know, that it is the hippest place on earth, like they say in Williamsburg.
So is that morality and a federal lawsuit, Professor?
Well, it's not the morality, it's the practicality. I don't understand why city planning refuses to allow this community, the Broadway Triangle, to fight for higher density zoning and pushes it on your community.
Right.
And it gets back to the need. Different places have different sort of genetic makeup in the quality of their neighborhood. Your neighborhood has historically been a low-rise community. It's covenanted, not discriminatory, but just to keep it one and two family houses. It seems to me that we should get back to what Scott Stringer was talking about. How do we really develop community-based and community-initiated planning rather than see it come down from the top? And if communities each had a mandate, we want you to find affordable housing, we want you to do meet this following moral and ethical principles, but you come up with the solutions, communities would do it. Believe me, they would do it. And in the Broadway Triangle, they would do it in a different way than they would in Lefferts Gardens. And I think and in Prospect Heights. And it seems to me that we need to fight, and this is something we can do, on more of an initiative by the city to respect local community-initiated plans and to allow the planning process to come from the bottom up rather than from the top down.
Okay, we're going to take it over to this side. Share your name and neighborhood and your question.
Greetings, my name is A.M. Goodrich, and I also represent Crown Heights, but I also as a former member of Occupy Brooklyn, still a member of Occupy Wall Street, and also part called the Crown Heights Tenant Union, including bloggers like Brownstone and Sheepshead Bites. And I've been through like a lot of gentrification business, not just here in the Central Park, but also Southern Brooklyn. Talk about Sheepshead Bay, Brighton Beach, and Coney Island. Could be the next risk taker of being gentrified. And we've been over again feeling like filled with the anti-development and like overdevelopment problem that they play Southern Brooklyn for.
Is there 10 a particular years. Question for those neighborhoods?
My question is how does Sheepshead Bay, Brighton Beach, and Coney Island be threatened to be gentrified and like in case when Brighton Beach being withdrawn from being upzoned?
I know that you've done a lot of work on coastal Brooklyn, as we call it now, particularly post-Sandy, and you've done some pioneering thought on gentrification post the storm. Let's start with you.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. I mean, Coney Island just went through a bitter, bitter battle over a rezoning plan that was allegedly to benefit people who are living there, but I think, you know, is turning out to be pushing out businesses and turning out to be, you know, bringing in new residents, not necessarily benefiting the folks who are there. Yeah. And in Brighton, I feel like you're seeing just an influx of people. You're seeing both the sort of more natural, if you want to call it that, gentrification and the unnatural city-sponsored gentrification going on. I think that one thing that could have gone on in Coney Island and in that whole area is more organizing across different communities. You know, I don't think you ever really saw the folks living down at the west end of Coney Island and the folks in the amusement district and the folks in Brighton who are fighting this all getting together and saying, okay, this is something that affects all of us. Just because, you know, it's hard and coalition building is difficult, but I think that's sort of the next step is, you know, it's interesting having people from different neighborhoods here on this panel talking about that and sort of saying, okay, how can we, you know, organize citywide and, you know, as opposed to just fighting battle by battle by battle.
So, Professor Schiffman, is there a way to build better, smarter, greener, and more affordably in Coney Island than those people who are so impacted by this storm?
Well, I think Coney Island and the Rockaways and places like that, we really have to build a lot smarter. And in many cases, that may be not to build at all. Because unfortunately, some of those people who will live there will be in harm's way, not maybe tomorrow, but definitely in 10 or 15 years, definitely by the end of the century. And so what really bothers me with some of the initiatives the city is taking, one in the Rockaways, is they're ready to build upper income housing right near where public housing may very well have to sacrifice their first floors. And they'll see this luxury housing being built next door to them and say, you're giving us a song by telling us we have to vacate our first two floors in public housing. But if we don't vacate those two floors and we don't build smart in the Rockaways, those people's lives are in jeopardy. So I really am very torn by the desire to see places to build, the desire to retain low-income housing, and the desperate need, I think, for us to adapt how we build in those areas so we build safely, not only for today, but for the day after tomorrow.
Okay.
WBAI, New York.
Good evening. Joe Gonzalez, Bedford-Stuyvesant. I direct my question to Professor Schiffman. Business improvement districts, and what do you believe their role in gentrification is? And more specifically, do you believe it's time to just end the bids that the city has put into place in recent years?
My short answer is yes. I think business improvement districts lead to the discrimination of one district versus the other. I originally was supportive of them, but what I've seen is that they help richer communities become richer and poorer communities really are left behind. I think some real reforms are needed in the business improvement districts, basically involving tenants in the decisions, and by that I mean both residential and business tenants. Because when the bid is run primarily by those who own the buildings, then it doesn't lead to the stability of that area, nor to its cultural retention and its meaning to neighborhoods. So I'm very concerned about business improvement districts. I'm very concerned about people who would like to adopt that for residential areas. Mm-hmm. I don't like it being done for parks because we're winding up with a dual system in the city of New York. On the other hand, I'm a realist enough to know that you need to generate money in some cases, and particularly in our present situation. So sometimes you need to create those kinds of partnerships and programs, but you have to be very, very careful because in the end they come back to bite you.
Professor, so just so you know, we were concerned at the city council about bids, okay, and just had an oversight hearings, specifically unprecedented, directly on bids, and looked at tenant to ownership parity in terms of their voice in the development. Yeah. So we're right on par, kind of, I think, with what you're saying.
So what did you find? Give us a preview.
Well, we found that there were some egregious behavior that left out the voice in some districts, that left out the voice of the tenant as far as development was concerned. We found that in some districts there was some charges that, you know, shouldn't have existed. So we're looking at reforms within bids. But the program overall in some communities has worked well, where there's been no organization between on commercial districts.
Yeah.
So we don't want to, as they say down south, throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Well, I was going to ask you, Professor Zukin, how does this fit into the sort of Jane Jacobs dream of having the candle maker next to the butcher, next to the doctor, all of these people mixing and living and being cooperative together? Is that a formula that works in the city when her house just sold for $11 million?
Jane Jacobs was not envisioning the Dwayne Reed next to the yoga studio next to the HSBC branch. No. I'm back to business improvement districts. As Ron Schiffman suggested, this is a model that has been exported around the world, and it has a lot of appeal to city governments because the business improvement districts fund themselves. But all around the world, the bids often give much more power to the commercial building owners than to the stores that are their tenants, and much more power to the big stores and the chain stores, which often don't even want